those farmers, when they come and farm your land, they're not just stewarding it the way that you want them to steward. They are building a new ecosystem. They are building their business, and if they are practicing regenerative agriculture, they're especially helping with that land. And so if they don't have ownership in it, sometimes how much can they actually put into it? Wouldn't it be awesome if you split your land and have them be your neighbor and you can build that relationship with them and diversify that economy? Because it's beyond just that soil and land that they're farming in, but it's really building a more food secure community in your community. So
welcome to the 369th installment of Ear to the Ground, the Land Stewardship Project's podcast on family farming, regenerative agriculture, community food systems, and local democracy. I'm Brian DeVore, editor of the Land Stewardship Letter. For Kazua Berry, farming has always been inextricably linked to food and family. When she was two, she immigrated to America with her parents, who were originally from Laos. Kazua has fond memories of helping them out in their vegetable plots and at the farmer's market. So, it's no surprise that after moving to Minnesota, Kazua sought out ways to get involved in a way of life she sees as critical to creating vibrant, healthy communities. Like many emerging farmers, she and her husband got their start at Big River Farms, an incubator program for beginning organic growers operated by the Food Group. Today, they have a small-scale farm in Maplewood, Minnesota, and Kazua is the Food Group's farm director. In that position, she oversees such initiatives as the Big River Farms Education Program. She also coordinates the annual Emerging Farmers Conference, an annual event that's evolved over the years into a major venue for new immigrants, farmers of color, and other emerging food producers to get together and learn how to build and sustain viable farming operations in the region. Kazua's personal and professional background has provided her with an excellent vantage point to observe the opportunities and challenges faced by new immigrant and farmers of color. Not surprisingly, they face many of the hurdles that get in the way of their white counterparts, such as access to affordable land and consistent, profitable markets. But emerging farmers must also often grapple with racism, both within the government bureaucracies that service and regulate the agricultural sector, as well as in communities that aren't used to seeing anyone who isn't white owning and working the land. One thing that's clear is that we have a great opportunity here in the Midwest to help launch countless entrepreneurial agrarians. Many of the emerging farmers Kazua works with are producing vegetables on just a few acres or less, and are finding that the growing demand for locally produced food can offer a good market. Imagine what would happen if more landowners opened up even just a tiny portion of their larger corn and soybean operations, for example, to some of these specialty food producers. But as Kazua makes clear, renting that land may not be enough. To create a situation where these emerging farmers can build equity while producing food in a regenerative manner that builds soil health, they need to be in a position to own the land they till. Such a scenario is a win-win, since it's one way to create more neighbors in rural communities that are being hollowed out by an industrialized, consolidated system of agriculture. Kazua recently sat down to talk with me about the growing number of emerging farmers in the region and the benefits they can provide the land, our food system, and our communities. She started our conversation by providing a glimpse at her own family's farming legacy.
I would like to think that I am a farmer. I've been farming for a long time with my parents. They were immigrants, and I'm also an immigrant. Came when I was very little. We came from the refugee camps in Thailand to Stockton, California. We were sponsored by a Methodist church, and farming was the first kind of jobs that my parents can do because that was easy for them. They knew they already did it in Laos and Thailand, and so growing was easy for them, so they were farmhands. And then when we moved to Milwaukee, Wisconsin, that was also like another job that my parents were able to do, was go find jobs at farms. And so we did that, and I have always been with my parents. They didn't have childcare, so wherever they went, we went. Mm-hmm. And then my mom, we rented land at a company, and we... When I say land, it's like a small plot. And I've
always... This is vegetable farming.
Yep, yeah. We've always just grown with them, and we sold to like the grocery store. I remember days when I was probably like 6 or 7 years old. We were outside cleaning the mustard greens so we can bundle it, and it was being sold for $1 a bundle. So we would only get like a quarter for every bundle that we sold. So it wasn't a lot, but back in the days, that was a lot for us. So I've always just grew things with my parents. I learned a lot about growing from my mom. There's 8 of us kids in my family. So I was one of those kids that actually just took off with growing. And then when I moved here to Minnesota, I call her my aunt. She's basically my friend from school's mom that just kind of adopted me into their family. And I've helped them farm as well. And I truly believe that if you have land or space to grow food, that's a right that you should have. And so people in the community knew the work that I did with farming and growing food. So I became a staff at Big River Farms to teach farmers. And then my husband also wanted to learn how to farm. He's never grown food before. Mm-hmm. So we decided to rent land at Big River Farms to start farming. I knew how to farm, me teaching him. So we built our farm business together. And now we have a homestead in Maplewood where okay. we're just growing in our yard and growing for markets. But then I have a toddler now, so yeah. we're not doing much of that, but right. yeah.
It sounds like you had kind of always glommed on to raising stuff, but I wonder, because sometimes kids who parents are so involved with agriculture, they're like, oh, I don't want to have anything to do with that. It doesn't sound like that was the case with you.
I was always very fascinated, and I think the food tastes different. You know, I learned more deeply about how different that food tasted when we grew our own vegetables, but then we would forage and we would fish and hunt. And then when we bought like meat, we would go to a farm and buy it directly. We would bring home 30 plus live chickens and process it in our inner city home, uh-huh. in our garage. Like, I grew up with that kind of lifestyle.
Yeah.
I grew up learning how to properly process a cow or a pig. So I can handle that yeah. kind of process. So when I came to college here in Minnesota, I had to buy meat on my own at the grocery store, and I could not believe how different that meat tasted.
Yeah.
And I learned from my mom that there's probably chemicals or all these things that are put into the meat that wasn't good. So my mom taught me so much about like the importance of buying food directly from growers who actually really took care of the land, and also knowing the difference between like the taste of things that are grown in season, like tomatoes and cucumbers and herbs that are grown on the ground in the season and you're growing it versus the ones that you're buying at the store.
Right. Was a little bit of a shock to come. So you had experience with it in California, to come to Minnesota, where we do have summer and spring, believe it or not. But was that a little bit of an adjustment to growing in this climate a little bit?
Well, we actually moved to Wisconsin.
Oh.
So my family still lives in Wisconsin.
Oh, right, in Milwaukee. Yep.
And then I'm here in Minnesota. But I remember when we landed, and my aunt had these big things where they were coats, but we didn't know what that was because we went from Thailand to California to like these ginormous things that you're supposed to put on your body. And my aunt said, you need to put that on because it's snowing. So my first introduction to snow was coming to Wisconsin from the airport to her van. So that was shocking. So we kind of knew how to grow in Wisconsin already with the climate. But of course, there are other issues with climate change that's impacting the way that we farm now.
Tell me a little bit about the work you do with Big River Farms. And maybe give a little, for folks who aren't familiar, what is Big River Farms? What does it do? And then what is it, the work that you do with that?
Yeah, so Big River Farms is an incubator training program where we are located in Marine in St. Croix. It's land access as well as like having hands-on training opportunities. And this program used to be called, used to be its own independent nonprofit with Minnesota Food Association in 2017, merged with the Food Group. So the Food Group is our organization, and I oversee all of the sustainable agricultural work that we do. So Big River Farms is a portion of that work. Our agri-solar, where we are farming in between solar panels, is part of the farm work. And then our Emerging Farmers Conference and the micro farm located at our headquarters in New Hope is part of that farm work. And with Big River Farms, it's really a unique program because we have a very intensive curriculum that farmers enter into starting January. we provide theoretical workshops and classes, and then the idea is that they'll have like hands-on opportunities to be able to like apply what they learn. And then we also help with the education on market and scalability of farming. So people enter into the space, not a community garden, but you are entering with the intention to be a farmer.
Do you have a very rough idea, how many folks have come through that program? How many are you've kind of incubated through that program?
Yeah, well, our MN coordinator, she just put together the list, and it's not by all means comprehensive. There's probably some missing data, but probably at least 100 names on that list. And we have quite a bit of farmers who have grown from that program and bought land and have established themselves and have been deeply connected within their communities as well.
So part of what Big River Farms is doing, are they the main driver behind the Emerging Farmers Conference? Can you talk a little bit about the Emerging Farmers Conference? I think that's a really... because that's had such a huge influence.
Yeah, the Emerging Farmers Conference definitely was a combination of grassroots-led organizations that came together, seeing that there was like a gap for support for immigrant farmers. Mm-hmm. And some of those organizations were early on, and I know some of them, like, I don't even remember their names because they no longer exist. Latino Economic Development Center, LEDC, RTC, MFA, as when it was MFA, was the driver of that, and then this was in combination and collaboration with MDA and FSA and NRCS. So, like, there's also government relationships and support with this. But yes, currently it is considered a program of the food group, and we're the main host of the conference, and we provide a lot of staff support. And this is really providing like a lot of interpretation and language equity with this work. So it's not just about getting the education and training that farmers need at the conference, but also establishing that connection that very much needed, which is language piece, mm-hmm. which a lot of farmers don't get support on. So we already have like our language system kind of put together. So it's really much more easier for us to just implement it at the conference, where a lot of folks from all over the country really calls on us and ask us how we provide so many different support for different languages.
Yeah. I mean, how many languages are you dealing with?
It's between 7 to 10 languages, wow. depending on the need, yeah. you know. So it really depends on our outreach and the need and the communities that come in. A lot of our farmers speak a lot of different languages, too. So
right.
the cool thing is sometimes we'll provide like 6 or 7, and that farmer can choose which language they want to get support in. So we have very talented and gifted farmers, for sure.
It's a reminder, we're not all like me. I speak one language, and I don't speak that one that great. I think that's really exciting. I remember going to one of the first Emerging Farmer conferences and walking into the room where they had people with the headphones on doing the interpretation, and I was like, oh boy, this is a whole different wrinkle in farming here in Minnesota. It was really exciting to see, and that was way back when, and it's just grown since then. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's exciting to see one offshoot of that, or one of the things that I think maybe resulted that was the Emerging Farmers Office or mm-hmm. department there at the Minnesota Department of Ag. Yeah. I think that must be kind of neat to see.
Yeah. It's definitely a huge thing, you know, having an Emerging Farmers Office that's really focused on our farmers who just really don't have enough resources already in everyday life. But if you want to enter into farming in itself, there's definitely not enough resources. And so having this office and having priorities be put into supporting beginning farmers or farmers who are wanting to grow into that, or even new farmers who have been farming with their parents, but they want to become independent and farm on their own. Like, all of this matters.
I think one of the things that strikes me, either going to the Emerging Farmers Conference or going by the Big River Farms, or just in general, some of these meetings we have on land access where folks from a lot of different backgrounds show up, is you really struck at how much. So the narrative in America today is, no young people are interested in farming. We've completely found that that's not true through our Farm Beginnings program, for example, which is always filled to capacity. And any of the workshops we have, there's so many young farmers there. I know we don't have all the solutions for those folks, but that just to see that interest must help you get energized for that.
Absolutely. It's very motivating. You know, a lot of our Hmong community we're starting to see an increase of Hmong folks or couples that are getting more interested in farming. Mm-hmm. But before, it was even parents that would say, like, don't, like, you need to go get a doctor's degree or, like, a medical degree or become a lawyer or do something practical because farming is not sustainable. We're poor because we can't do anything else. And farming within the immigrant community was associated with, like, lack of education, lack of this, right? But I love seeing the influx of and the growth of young folks who come from IT backgrounds, who come from medical backgrounds that are like, I'm actually entering into this because I see that there is a need to have diversified strength and skills in this space to continue to grow food for our community.
It's a profession. I mean, it's not just like you said, oh, I can't do anything else, so I'll do that. Yeah. We've seen that in the Midwest for years, that agriculture wasn't given the respect that it deserved. Yeah. So it's great to see some of these folks who are really sharp, maybe have other options, but they're like, oh, this is farming is what I think is really, a choice. Yeah, that's a good point. Well, let's switch gears a little bit and talk about land access, because I think, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I get the sense through Big River Farms and your other work, the farmers that you're working with are running into the same barrier that all beginning farmers run into. We definitely see it through Farm Beginnings. They get this great training, great background in agronomic practices, business practices, and all that. Get out there in the real world, quote unquote, land access is this, it's like this stop, can't get over that barrier kind of thing. Can you talk a little bit about the land access challenges that the farmers you're working with face? I guess, and particularly how it may be, what is the specific issues that a farmer of color or a new immigrant farmer would run into that maybe other farmers wouldn't run into when it comes to land access?
I think for a starter is even like the qualification for that financial support. For example, our farmers, a lot of them have not been taught that they need to have their financial records or their record keeping where in a way where they can have that track record. And if they should apply for a FSA direct loan, then they would qualify for it. But most of the times farmers don't have those, they're not equipped. So for the starter point is that they don't have the equipment or the resources to even enter into buying or enter into any capital expense. So that's one. But the other issue is like, a lot of land near the city is very, very pricey. Yeah. So farmers are kind of forced to go further out, maybe an hour and a half or 2 hours far away. And oftentimes, some of those communities are not accepting of new farmers or farmers who don't look like that community.
Right.
And another issue is trying to, as a farmer who has kids, like trying to decide if this is the school system I want my kids to enter, or can they even enter into this space? I've heard from plenty of farmers who have to live in those spaces because they bought land, where they have shared stories with me about their kids and the racism and all of that that they faced with having to have their kids integrate into those systems. And that makes it really challenging for farmers to decide, like, this is me uprooting my family to go into a system where the values are not shared.
You're right. It plays into a little bit this idea of farming isn't just about learning the practices and learning the business and learning how to market, but you have to look at the quality of life kind of in a holistic manner. And if your family isn't happy and you're not happy, and it's just not a community that on the free time that you have when you're not farming that you're not happy in, then that's all part of the package, really. That must be something you really see.
Absolutely. It is a lifestyle. Farming is not something where you, quote unquote, can do part-time.
Yeah.
We have a lot of our farmers currently in our program. They're working full-time, and then they're going to the farm 20-plus hours in addition to their workload.
Mm-hmm.
And I think just thinking through that in itself is a barrier and challenge. It's like, can they transition into being a full-time farmer or farmer who can farm at scale that provides support? And another challenge, Brian, too, is like if they were to buy farmland and their kids are young or they have dependent, like, or they're supporting their elders in their family and they need some of those government services that helps with medical assistance and food and things like that, can they truly be able to support their family by moving away and having those county support? So it's also like the transference of county support to a different county and all that headache that comes with that. So there's a lot of barriers that even goes into land access. And once you're established, what about the infrastructure? What about all the stuff that builds you and helps you scale up, you know. Mm-hmm. If you take out a loan, you are in a new land. You have to reestablish that land and reestablish the way that you farm and grow your markets and all of that. And are you able to pay that loan off with not even having, might not be able to take the markets with you if you're moving 2-3 hours away. Mm-hmm. So there's like a whole business thing that becomes very challenging when you're trying to access land.
You recently spoke at our family farm breakfast at the Capitol, and I think a really good point you made was you have landowners who reach out to you who have good intentions. They're like, yeah, I'd like to provide access to my land for new immigrants, farmers of color, but I want to rent it. And you were talking about, you know, maybe they have good intentions there, but that's a little bit of, that can be a little bit of a problem as far as building equity in the long term and some of those other things. Can you talk a little bit about why that's, maybe we need folks to look beyond what access is, and it's not just renting a little piece of their land?
Those farmers, when they come and farm your land, they're not just stewarding it the way that you want them to steward. They are building a new ecosystem. They are building their business. If they are practicing regenerative agriculture, they're especially helping with that land. And so if they don't have ownership in it, sometimes how much can they actually put into it? But more importantly, asparagus or apples or things like that that are perennial, they wouldn't invest in it because they're not going to be able to take it with them. And yes, what if you have your own apples and your own asparagus? Again, those are yours and they're not the farmers. They've been cultivating it, but when it's time for them to have their own, they're not, you're not going to give them that tree.
Yeah.
So I think there is a lot of value with equity-based mindset with ownership. And wouldn't it be awesome if you split your land and have them be your neighbor and you can build that relationship with them and diversify that economy? Because it's beyond just that soil and land that they're farming in, but it's really building a more food secure community in your community. So food security, I think there is a correlation between ownership of diverse communities that can really help with that.
It's kind of creating that, the community, kind of widening your view of what the community is. Mm-hmm. It also, I think you've touched on an issue, we have plenty of farmers who have 200, 300, 400, 500 acres.
Yes.
That's not what, for example, a vegetable farmer or even a fruit farmer would need. Mm-hmm. They just need a piece carved out. Yeah, they need to have kind of long-term access. And one of the things that you brought up is this idea if you're putting in perennials or whatever. But the other issue I've seen farmers run into is if they're only renting it and they only have a year lease, or maybe it's a couple years lease, they don't have a big incentive to build soil health. Yeah, that must be a big one.
That is huge. You know, compost is so expensive. And also, if you are saying, well, people can cover crop, the seeds are not heavy, you know, they're not costly, but why would the farmer regenerate it for you?
Yeah.
You know, like, I think when you are expecting folks to come and steward something, you need to also be a steward by thinking about the longevity of the practices. And so I think that is really important. And I hear that too often where farmers are like feeling conflicted because most farmers are on a year-to-year lease. And oftentimes farmers get displaced without even notification of being able to sign on for more years. I want to just encourage landlords or landowners who are transitioning to really think about the kind of legacy that they want to leave and not think about it in a way of like what kind of legacy that they are ashamed of, what kind of legacy that their ancestors have done and they're carrying. I think they should think about the legacy moving forward, which is really supporting the communities of color and our indigenous communities to really create a more diverse system. And even if your name is not known, know that the memories that the wind carries is infinite. And I think that if you're able to help change the food system by transitioning your land to more diverse communities in such a way where it is equitable and supportive of our system, I think that is a huge win.
I guess this is a two-part question. I mean, have you seen any programs or any initiatives out there in the past couple of years that have helped kind of us get over this barrier a little bit? And then also, think about this. What would be a couple three things or whatever that would really help us get over this land access bump that so many farmers are running into?
I can answer the first question because I think that's an, I mean, not an easy one, but that's there are people that are doing it. Renewing the countryside with their land access navigators. They work with farmers. And, you know, LSP, you guys do pretty good with, like, listing land and trying to connect folks. Of course, you know, there can be strength, you know, ways to strengthen that. And then, like, American Farmland Trust or when there are trust, agrarian trust folks involved or, you know, having those kind of conversations about what does it look like for land transfer? Mm-hmm. I think those are really important, but one thing that I would like to see is more concrete pathways and things that are happening in a way where it's duplicable or meaningful for farmers, and we're not just having conversations about it. You know, I think we've been having conversations for a very long time. So I think it's time to start creating some solution-oriented, concrete things that can move forward, which I don't really have an answer for that because I think it really has to do with the landowners, with them themselves, to really dig deep and relinquish some of those land.
Yeah, are there like some government programs that have been good lately or that could something that could be put in place? I mean, you talked about some of the kind of the barriers related to just to getting access to basic programs. I mean, one thing I have seen a little bit is there's a little bit more of a at some of the NRCS offices a little bit of a changing view of what is agriculture. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not just corn and beans.
Yeah, I really do think that since a lot of these issues are systemic, that it really does need to take efforts from the administration to acknowledge and to keep it moving. Mm-hmm. I mean, we know what the state that we are in right now, and it makes it really challenging because we spent the last 5 or so years building relationship with USDA, and now we are here. And so I think, how do we find alignment as a country that really says these are the farmers we want to also prioritize and not create buckets where people are fighting for scraps?
Mm, that's a really good point. It's this whole, and that's the elephant in the room right now. Let's face it, as we're talking, there is almost a war on immigrants in general. And so, but also what that feeds into is this whole idea of the other and people who aren't like me are competing for my, what I should have. And I think that's a really good point that you put, that we have to create a situation where, yeah, we're not all competing for different buckets of resources, and it's all this kind of Hunger Games type of situation.
Yeah, and there's rooms. Like when I spoke at MFMA's conference, I talked about silos. I think there is...
What's MFMA?
Minnesota Farmers Market Association.
Oh, okay.
And I talked about silos and how I think it's important for us to de-silo ourselves more than anything. And I think there is room and space for commodity farmers. I think there's room and space for monoculture to a certain extent. But we shouldn't, as specialty crop producers or people who are farming on a small scale or family farms, we shouldn't also try to force room for us. Like, there should just be room there to start with.
No.
And at the moment, there's not a lot of subsidies to support farmers who farm the scale that we farm and the farmers that we teach. There's a lot of subsidy and financial assistance for commodity and row crop growers. So, like, really thinking through all those specific systems that are supporting the other, the quote-unquote other farmers, because even a lot of producers entering into this space, especially some of our indigenous communities where they don't identify as farmers because the name within farmer, being a farmer itself, is a form of colonization.
Right.
And so really thinking about all of those systems and how do we really put efforts and also create a system to support and elevate the work that actually feeds human beings.
As part of this, we talked a little bit about, you said in some ways it's about food security. You know, that's a big one in that the more diverse, I mean, we saw this with COVID and we see this more and more with consolidation, but the more we can kind of diversify our supply of food locally, that's a big one. But the other one is, hey, trying to show that these specialty farmers, vegetable farmers, folks who are farming on a smaller scale, but they're producing a lot of food, really contribute to an economy, a local economy, because I think for commodity farming, the corn soybean system in particular, I always say, put it this way, there's a lot of sound and fury out there. There's a lot of economic activity, quote unquote, in the big picture.
Mm-hmm.
But when you drill down to it, not much of that is staying local and building wealth in the local community.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas from what I've seen of the smaller scale vegetable operations and the kind of the produce operations, it's building wealth locally. I mean, it's supporting local families, and it's going straight into the eater and that kind of thing.
Yeah, that's exactly it. That's what's happening right now. You know, a lot of our farmers. So the one thing that we're running into is teaching farmers about taxes.
Mm-hmm.
And our farmers are paying taxes, and they are filing their taxes, but when they enter into becoming an LLC or a sole proprietor, like their naming entities, the taxing is different.
Right.
And so it's like a new thing that people are learning, but we have to keep in mind all of that effort is going back into the system.
Yeah.
I mean, we saw this when COVID hit, where we couldn't like distribute or buy from across state lines, and all the farmers came together, and then there were a lot of community efforts in matchmaking communities that needed food directly from the growers here, and that really helped elevated our ability to access food. Even now at the food group with the egg situation, for our affordable grocery, we were able to get eggs and selling them for $2.65 a dozen compared to the stores.
Oh my gosh.
Because we're buying it from farmers here.
Right.
That's like the power of understanding the food movement. And yes, it's food insecurity that we want to address, but also the knowledge and the empowerment of the person receiving, the consumers,
mm-hmm.
to understand the importance of connecting themselves with farmers and getting food. I've been buying eggs from farmers for a very long time. I've been paying $5 to $6 a dozen. So with this new thing, it doesn't faze me
because
I've already been doing that. And same thing with honey and all of that. So I think it's really strengthening all the pieces that are interconnected with like consuming the food.
I go back to this idea of us, particularly here in the Midwest, we have to re-envision what we consider farming and agriculture is. It's like you're not a real farmer unless you're farming 1,000 acres of corn and beans, and that on a per acre basis, less than an acre, you can produce a lot of food for a lot of people in a small area.
Absolutely. We had a farmer who was growing an acre and a half, maybe not even like a full acre and a half. And he was producing so much food. I mean, he easily grossed over 120,000.
Wow.
On that. Like, but didn't he do that at the cost of his family, you know, and the stress of all of that? Because it is really hard being a farmer, because he also worked full time.
Mm-hmm.
His family worked full time, but still did all of this and was able to move food and help feed our communities. But I think there's that push and pull and tension between farmers, or even like USDA folks not understanding who the farmers are. We also have to abide by very intensive regulation on food safety practices.
Right.
Just as much as, I mean, maybe even more so than the other commodity growers. You know, we have to do a lot of training and a lot of understanding, like, the post-harvest and handling, the regulations of your organic. We're organic certified. So the organic practice is really intense and costly for us to do that. So it's costing us a lot of money to be good stewards, but we do it anyways.
Yeah. If there's somebody who is interested in getting started farming, particularly if there's somebody who's new to this, fairly new to this country, what's some of their first steps that you would recommend? What is it? Where, you know, it can be pretty overwhelming. The internet can be a black void of going from one place to another. But what would you've been around long enough? I think you've seen kind of what works and what can kind of save people some heartache and kind of missteps.
I would say for starter, there's a lot of free field days or, you know, farm visits that people can attend to even, like, visually see what's available and what the work is. But more importantly, if they want hands-on stuff, I would say go volunteer with a farmer to learn. Like, spend a weekend with them so that you know how labor-intensive it is. You know, quite a bit of farmers that come to our program, Brian, they've been referred through family or friends or communities because they've come and help at the farm there, and they either love it and they're like, well, I just appreciate the food system and the farmers and I would never want to be a farmer. Or they would love it where they're like, oh, let me learn more about this program so I can enter into this program. Because there is a certain amount of commitment that we're asking for farmers as they enter into this program.
Right.
So it's not for everyone, for sure.
Yeah.
But those, I promise you, when you come, you will be able to either have a deeper appreciation for the food system and like the farmers who actually grow the food that you eat, or you will we will definitely deter you from entering farming as a career path, because it would, you would just realize how hard it is.
Right. You know, that's the same with Farm Beginnings. We consider it a success if somebody goes through the program and says, you know what, this isn't for me, because we don't want to set them up for failure, you know, and just say, well, yeah, no, anybody can do it. Well, no, not everybody can do it. It's not a good fit for everybody. So how long have you been doing this with Big River Farms?
I'm entering 5 years.
5 years. So, and then you know, you have this extensive background, and your family was always been involved with food production. I mean, how do you, and there is a lot going on right now, and a lot of it is not good, but, I mean, how do you feel in general about the future for emerging farmers and for this kind of local food production, that kind of thing? Do you feel like maybe there are still some opportunities out there? Do you feel positive, or is it just we've got a whole lot of work to do here?
Well, for sure, we have a lot of work to do. I think if I zoom out system-wise, I don't feel good about the systems. Mm-hmm. I think it's getting worse, and it'll probably collapse. Certain things that are really important for farmers as a resource. But if I zoom in and work with the day-to-day farmer, they are still growing. We have our farmers that have been growing in our greenhouses already. A lot of farmers are farm planning. Mother Earth is going to survive with or without us. So I feel good about leaning into community resilience. People who might not even be able to farm anymore because of time, or they have to like focus energy elsewhere, they're still going to grow food. Mm-hmm. So food production will continue to be there. And I think that with all of these systems that are being at risk for food security purposes, I think farmers are going to step up. And I just hope that we are ready to help support those farmers when that time comes.
For more information related to helping emerging farmers launch successful operations by, among other things, providing them access to land, see the podcast page for Ear to the Ground episode 369 at landstewardshipproject.org. If you have comments or suggestions about this podcast, contact Brian DeVore at bdevore@landstewardshipproject.org, or you can call 612-816-9342. By the way, it helps us greatly if you can give Ear to the Ground a rating on whatever podcast platform you utilize. And word of mouth is the best way to spread the news about our podcast. If you like what you hear, tell at least one person about LSP's Ear to the Ground. Thanks to Laura Borgendell, Western Minnesota musician, for Ear to the Ground's theme music. And a special thank you to all of Land Stewardship Project's members who make initiatives such as this podcast possible. If you're not a member, visit landstewardshipproject.org to learn how you can support LSP. Thanks for listening.